the perpetual need to create liberal elite plots around every corner just literally doesn't allow for a kind of empirical or values-based look at what something like tightening accessibility to lethal firearms might actually accomplish.
Hello, I'm Jeff Campuservice for the Niskanen Center. Welcome to the Vital Center podcast, where we try to sort through the problems of the muddled, moderate majority of Americans, drawing upon history, biography, and current events. I'm honored to be joined today by Greg Sargent of The Washington Post. He's an opinion columnist covering national politics. Greg is one of the two writers of the Plumline blog, along with Paul Waldman, and is the author of the terrific 2018 book, An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Greg is one of our sharpest opinion writers. I refer not just to his intellect, but to his razor-edged opinions, which, shall we say, have been known to engender a certain amount of resentment from parties on the receiving end. But I've learned a tremendous amount from reading your columns, Greg, and I am in awe of the Stakhanovite frequency with which you produce them.
I'm in awe of what you've done too, Jeff. You've helped me enormously over the years.
You're very kind, Greg. Just so readers know, if I'm counting correctly, you authored or co-authored 34 columns this month. I don't know how you do it. But before we get into the substance of your writing, can you tell me something about your background and how you got into opinion writing?
Well, sure. I took a bit of a more traditional journalistic path at the outset than I think a lot of opinion people do today. I started out writing for a small weekly newspaper in southern Manhattan. It was actually a community newspaper. I was able to move from there to the New York Observer and then ultimately to New York Magazine. But at that point, I started to become much more interested in the liberal blogosphere because what was happening then was the Iraq War was really getting underway and there were obvious major failings with the way the mainstream press was handling George W. Bush and the invasion. And it felt to me like the liberal blogosphere was doing something new and exciting and really explaining to people what was going wrong with some of our major institutions in a way that you really couldn't get pretty much anywhere else. And so I took a detour from there into liberal blogging at Talking Points Memo, run by Josh Marshall, and then went from there to the Washington Post Company.
Where did you grow up and where did you go to school?
I grew up in Lower Manhattan and Greenwich Village, actually. In those days, it was a little bit different than it looks now. And I went to public schools all the way, including Bronx Science, which is, for your listeners, a public special high school for kids who pass a certain test to get in. And it was a very good school. And then I went from there to Hunter College and SUNY Purchase, and I did a year in Paris abroad as part of an exchange program and ultimately graduated from Hunter College and then kind of blundered around and waited tables and then eventually kind of found my way into this journalistic stuff at the small community paper. And from there, I was able to get out of waiting tables for good.
That's an interesting trajectory. I actually have a bit of a personal connection to some of those institutions you mentioned. Hunter College is one of the constituent colleges of the City University of New York, and I was a fellow at the Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute at Hunter College about a decade ago, which actually is in the townhouse that Franklin and Eleanor used to live in. Mm. So I acquired a certain knowledge of and respect for Hunter College. And my dad also went to the Bronx High School of Science.
Did he really?
Yeah. And, you know, I remember diverging here a little bit, that about a decade or so, Christopher Hayes came out with a book called, I always want to say it's Our Crappy Elites, but actually I think it's actually called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. And he went to the Hunter College High School, which I realize is
right.
Separate from Hunter College itself.
But that's a different thing entirely, yeah.
But Hunter College High School is one of those public competitive admission high schools like the Bronx High School of Science. And he focused on, I think it was a 2010 graduation speech at which the speaker had said of the whole Hunter College experience, "I don't deserve any of this and neither do you," pointing to his fellow graduands. And that was kind of the big pushback that we started to see against meritocracy in the name of racial equity. Were those things that people talked about at the Bronx High School of Science back in your day?
Well, I was busy playing poker in the cafeteria, so I probably wouldn't have participated in those conversations. Actually, in fairness, I did also play a fair amount of chess. In those days, there was, since you want personal stuff, I'll throw some out there. In those days, there was a very vibrant chess scene in the Bronx Science Cafeteria, and it brought together kids from all over the city, different classes of all kinds, who would just get into these really very robust competitions that could sometimes end up in violence when things went wrong.
As chess games so often do, yes.
Well, you know, we think passions run high in politics. Chess is a completely different thing entirely. But no, that was not something that was discussed that much in those days at Bronx Science.
I actually found the Netflix series A Queen's Gambit, The Queen's Gambit, to be quite fascinating as a glimpse into that world as well.
It's a really interesting world, and I think that a lot of people don't really know really quite what it entails. It's you go to a place in New York like Washington Square Park or certain parts of Central Park, and you'll see all these kind of rough-looking chess hustlers around. These guys are making a real living doing that stuff, although I haven't been in New York in a number of years, so maybe they've been cleaned out of there in some way or other. But it was really quite striking how back in like the 80s and 90s, you could go to a park and you would see all manner of very tough-looking characters playing incredibly good chess. And it could be just a really great diversion to just watch that stuff happen.
And chess, of course, is its own form of meritocracy.
Well, yes, I think that's right.
So you, I think, were an English major at Hunter, is that right?
Yes.
How'd you go from Bronx Science to being an English major?
Well, I missed Stuyvesant High School by maybe 2 or 3 points. Mm. And being someone who grew up in the West Village, Stuyvesant High School was just a short bus ride across town. In those days, it was at 15th and 1st. And because I missed it by 2 or 3 points, I ended up commuting to the Bronx for 4 straight years, which was a long commute through some pretty rough territory. And that doesn't really answer your question, but I went to Bronx Science because it was the best school on offer for me, not necessarily because I had an interest in science. And you didn't have to have an interest in science to go to one of those the specialized science high schools. They also had high-level academics in all sorts of other fields, and plenty of people who were at Bronx Science were into the arts or into reading or hoped to do something in government or politics. So it was really, I think people think of those schools as being entirely science oriented, but they're really not. They had a very wide gamut of people from all over the city with all sorts of different interests. They're very interesting places.
What did you take away from your time in Paris?
Well, I learned to hitchhike to the south of France without getting, you know, killed. That a number of times. I actually did become close to fluent in French after the year was up, but not necessarily through school learning. It was through talking in everyday situations. And that was learning another language was a real eye-opener for me. I mean, the amount of concentration and dedication it took was very, very substantial, and it was very rewarding, too. I ended up reading a lot of newspapers in those days in order to try and figure out what was going on around me because I was in a foreign setting, and that kind of got me more and more interested in newspapers as a possible way forward.
Speaking of newspapers, did you have any models or strong influences on the journalistic or writing side?
Well, I was actually really fortunate to get blessed with a great editor at my very first job. His name was Jan Hodenfield. He passed away a number of years ago. He was a magazine writer who wrote about things like Woodstock back in the day, and he had some personal troubles and ended up sort of disappearing from journalism and then found his way back into it by getting an editor-in-chief job at this small community paper in southern Manhattan. Yet he turned out to be a brilliant editor. And I will say that Glenn Thrush, who's at the New York Times, was also at this paper when I was there. So we both learned from this guy, and he just kicked the living shit out of us day in and day out to make us write well. And he was quite an influence.
What was the name of that small community paper?
Downtown Express.
I take it it's no longer around.
I don't know. You know, I would not think it is.
Okay. So you came to the Washington Post, and you are one of the two writers, along with Paul Waldman, for the Plumline blog, as it's called. What's the significance of the title, The Plumline?
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that, because we've been getting this question for many years, and often the emails have a lot of snark in them about how you've misspelled plum, P-L-U-M-B, you moron. And the significance of it is actually that it's a cross between plumb line, P-L-U-M-B line, and the plumb book, P-L-U-M book, which is, I don't think many people know this, but it's a legendary insider's guide to D.C. that existed some time ago. And so we merged the two together to come up with plumb line, and I've been happy with it ever since.
Interesting.
Name, anyway, not the blog.
Oh, you should be happy with both. So there's actually a piece in Politico in January 2009 by Ben Smith, who, of course, has gone on to other things, entitled Sargent's Back. And Smith wrote, Greg Sargent, whom junkies got to know at TPM over the course of the cycle, by which he meant, of course, the 2008 election cycle, has a new blog up the plumb line at the new Washington Post site WhoRunsGov. The site appears to be meant to be a sort of more reliable Wikipedia for government officials. Not sure anyone would say that now. But anyway, what was interesting also was that there was a description of the blog, and I don't know if you wrote this or Paul or someone else, but it said that the goal of the blog would be to chronicle the new DC order as perceived and experienced by the people building it, as well as by the people who are resisting or at least coming to terms of it. The blog, it said, would be about political power in DC in the eyes of those who are welding it. But this blog emphatically won't be just about who's up and who's down, who's in and who's out. You read endlessly that Washington is a town that's obsessed with politics, no kidding, but presumably many of those who come here to work as political and policy professionals are interested in, you know, getting stuff done, in making policy and governing. So this blog will also be about policy as seen through the eyes of those who are making it, and governance as seen through the eyes of those who are trying to do it right. The aim is to report to you how the players themselves perceive what it is they're trying to do and why they're doing it. And, of course, to bring you plenty of news breaks and useful analysis. How has that basic goal stayed the same or changed over time?
Well, I think it's important to remember, and when we first started Plumline, Paul Waldman wasn't there at that point. It was as the blog for WhoRunsGov, which was really meant to be kind of a nonpartisan site in the sense that it would act as a, as you said, as a Wikipedia for players throughout the political world, both Republican and Democrat, both conservative and liberal, and so forth. And so originally, the blog was understood to be kind of a bit more nonpartisan and a bit less opinionated. But eventually, the Washington Post opinion section, which is, you know, obviously separate from WhoRunsGov, which let me clarify, WhoRunsGov was owned by the Washington Post company, but was not the Washington Post. And when Washington Post Opinions decided it wanted to hire a couple of new opinion bloggers, one of them was me, the other was Jennifer Rubin. And what they did was they moved my blog from WhoRunsGov over to Washington Post Opinions. And then at that point, it was really a full-fledged liberal opinion blog, as the counter to Jen Rubin's full-fledged conservative opinion blog.
As she was then.
As she was then.
Okay. And when did Paul come aboard?
I want to say probably maybe as early as 2012 or 2011, but I don't know exactly. I'd have to go back and check.
And what is the division of labor between you and Paul on the column?
I edit the blog, which means that I edit Paul's stuff. And then everything we do is overseen, obviously. But I write my pieces, he writes his pieces, I edit his pieces, and we sometimes, more and more lately, collaborate on pieces in order to, for efficiency purposes, really, and in order to kind of be able to do a little more reporting in the sense that one person can be writing, the other can make a few calls.
Is there any difference in your approach and Paul's?
So I think I come from more of a reporting background, whereas Paul really is newer to the reporting game, and although he does do some to inform his opinions. But generally speaking, I think I end up doing more interviews and trying to to bring in more facts from congressional sources and so forth than he does. But that is in no way meant to cast aspersions. He's a terrific writer and thinker, and he's just comes from a different background than I do.
You know, in a way, your column does remind me of Inside Report, which was co-written by Roland Evans and Robert Novak over the course of several decades. It was a six times a week column.
Yeah.
It mixed standard reporting and editorial opinions. And I guess if yours is the counterpart of Evans and Novak, what's kind of notable is how different it is from their typical inside baseball reporting on politics.
Yes, we definitely do not strive to be an inside baseball type blog.
What I found so unusual and really notable about your column is that nearly every one of your pieces will draw upon an interview you did with some person of notable but often highly specialized expertise who can allow you to connect to the political story of the moment with a larger social or political reality. Of course, you frequently consulted with a number of us at the Niskanen Center for our center-right views on policy and politics, and we're extremely grateful to that, but you cover a very wide range of people.
I feel very strongly that an opinion piece is improved, you know, dramatically by even the addition of just one additional outside voice. I sometimes say that when you do an opinion piece, if you quote someone saying something, you move the ball in another way. And I really, really feel somewhat, I have to confess, incomplete if I do a piece that doesn't have something like that in it.
So just to cite one example from the last week or so. Your column on May 25th was entitled How Democrats Can Address Our Hopelessness About Child Massacres. And you spoke to Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who is, you know, a longtime sponsor of gun control legislation since the Sandy Hook school shooting. And of course, here we are back at another school shooting tragedy coming out of Uvalde, Texas. And in that sense, that's probably the kind of reporting that a lot of people do. But part of what's notable about this latest school shooting tragedy is the widespread expectation that nothing is going to happen as a result of it, that the Democrats in Congress will advance legislation, the Republicans will block it, and that's the end of the story. So to address that, you actually went to Stanford political scientist Francis Fukuyama, connecting this phenomenon to what he'd written about in terms of the political decay of advanced societies. And this decay, you wrote, flows from complex processes that include interest group capture and the entrenchment of patterns in our institutions that constrain them from keeping pace with evolving problems. And that is the thesis that Fukuyama put forward in Political Order and Political Decay. How did that occur to you to make that connection?
Well, I had been looking for an opening to call Fukuyama about this topic for a while now. It had occurred to me that the Senate's failure to pass Build Back Better, which is Joe Biden's series of proposals on climate and inequality and childcare and so forth, it occurred to me that that Senate failure seemed to reflect something like what Fukuyama was talking about. I mean, if we're facing growing challenges in the form of a climate change emergency and soaring inequality and widespread child poverty, and the Senate can't act to fix those things simply because the 50th vote happens to belong to a Democrat who's from a state that Donald Trump carried by something like 40 points, then it seems like there's something fundamentally wrong with the institution vis-a-vis keeping pace with societal challenges. And I have been waiting for the moment to bring that up with Fukuyama, maybe to do an interview with him, but this just seemed like such a glaring example of it. Mass shootings are on the rise. Everyone wants to see action. Everyone's deeply frustrated by congressional paralysis, and yet it can't act. And so in this case, the filibuster's the problem, as opposed to the problem being simply who the 50th senator is. Although I should say that Manchin is also the primary obstacle to doing away with the filibuster to pass gun safety reforms or anything else. And so it just occurred to me that Fukuyama might have interesting things to say about how his kind of monumental theory of politics and political order and so forth illuminated this, and he did, I thought.
I agree, and I thought that was a representative column of yours in the sense that you're dealing with some very big concepts, and yet you are making it comprehensible to a general audience in only about 850 words.
Yeah, well, we try to boil the stuff down and make it accessible. I mean, that's a big aim of ours, so I appreciate you noticing that.
But sometimes, like today's column, for example, your column will actually be in the form of an interview, which will extend to something more like 1,500 words. And so today, your column was on how the AR-15 conquered America, as revealed by an industry insider. And this is largely in the form of essentially a kind of edited transcript of your conversation with Ryan Bussey, who was a former firearms industry executive. I thought that also was fascinating and revealing.
Yeah, well, he's a very interesting guy, and he took it to places that I really didn't expect. I went into this expecting him to talk about the firearms industry and how it has tried to exploit, how it's tried to shift the culture in a violent direction and then exploit that for profit, which he did. But what was very interesting to me was when he talked about this cultural shift being fed in some sense by the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, by the war on terror, by the imagery of American soldiers abroad getting beamed into living rooms, by the kind of Islamophobia that was coursing through all this. And when he brought that up, I really wanted to explore that with him some more, which we did. And I thought that I think that's a really interesting point, and I hope it gets debated because I have not seen that get much attention. And if it's true, if he's right about this, and I think he probably is, then the cost of the Iraq war and the war on terror is this, put it this way, this adds yet another tally onto the cost of the Iraq invasion and the war on terror.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly in permitting the rise of what Bussey called the idea of civil war / race war with heavily armed citizen patriots as your warriors. That's quite an alarming development.
I thought that was alarming. Yeah. And that was that to me. I'm glad you picked up on that, Jeff, because I thought that was very interesting, too. What's interesting is this overlap between the types of right-wing influencers who are prone to talk about, quote unquote, great replacement theory, who are prone to demagogue about the anarchist, leftist, terrorist threat that's overrunning the country, the overlap between those influencers and those who constantly fetishize the AR-15. It's clear that something profoundly deranged is going on here. It's not just a bunch of hobbyists out shooting for fun. And by the way, we did try to draw a distinction between this sort of derangement and the millions upon millions of gun owners who surely don't see it in these terms at all. I just wish those gun owners could be mobilized against the kind of deranged tendencies that are being loosed in their midst.
I completely agree. You know, there's a mix in your stories of responses to the political story of the moment with sort of longer term analyses. And sometimes those coincide. For example, you and I had talked about the great replacement theory that you just mentioned. And as it happened, that great replacement theory was what drove the Buffalo shooter on the same day that your column came out.
Can I just say, Jeff, that I really appreciate that you're available early in the morning for the interviews. In these days, with the internet being what it is, people who are very easily accessed at strange hours really are an enormous boon to people in my situation.
I'm happy to do what I can. But sort of what drives your selection of subjects?
Well, I try to look for something where I perceive like there's a kind of a hole in the debate, where there's maybe not a connection being drawn that should be drawn, or maybe there's kind of a failure of terminology on our part. In this particular case, that really applies, right? Great replacement theory is something that is we're all just trying to get our heads around right now, but the ideology is really getting mainstreamed, and there's a long, as I think you pointed out to me in your quotes, there's really a long kind of history and tradition that leads to this point. And for people to just think that this is just sort of a momentary spasm of radicalism seems to me to miss something much more fundamental about what's happening, and that's why I came to you for that in particular.
Well, thank you. I just mean this as an observation and not as a criticism. I think if an alien came down from space and could only learn about contemporary American politics from your column, the alien might think that the Republican Party was the party in charge of everything, given the preponderance with which they appear in your columns. Across the last month, for example, you know, just in terms of some of the headliners you're writing about, Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Perdue, Stefanik, you know, you kind of go down the list. Why is it that you have found yourself writing so much more about the Republicans than the Democrats, even though the Republicans are shut out of both the White House and Congress at the moment?
Well, I think this goes back to a couple of things we talked about before. One is that they wield outsized power because of the counter-majoritarian nature of our institutions, and that's something that needs to be spotlighted with regularity. And the second is that I think there's a sort of failure of our discourse to really capture what's going on with the Republican Party that's much more serious as a failing than, say, the way the discourse captures what's going on with Democrats. And in this sort of constant search for holes to fill in these conversations, we often end up focused on that. I will say we do try to write about Democrats a whole lot. And interestingly, to feed back to what you're talking about here, one of the things we regularly talk about Paul and I talk about when it comes to Democrats is their fundamental failure to reckon with the Republican Party of today. And we really do try to write about that a lot, and also about failures of messaging around the economy. And, you know, that's why we call senators like Chris Murphy and Brian Schatz pretty regularly to try and feature voices who are saying something a little different than what many mainstream Democrats are saying about the way forward in this particularly challenging moment. But I think that's actually a fair point you raise about the proportionality. I just think the reason for it is kind of rooted in the stuff we're talking about, the counter-majoritarian nature of our institutions, which gives them really, frankly, a ton of power to stop a lot of what Democrats want to do. And then, of course, their own radicalization, which I think that our daily political coverage often fails to capture adequately.
Along those lines, you devoted a considerable amount of attention across the past month to the Pennsylvania Republican gubernatorial nominee, Doug Mastriano. Why have you singled him out in your coverage?
Well, Doug Mastriano sits at the nexus of a lot of these pathologies, right? He's essentially a white Christian nationalist and pretty open about his desire to bring white Christian nationalism to his understanding, if that's the right word for it, of how democracy should function. Mastriano is also running for governor of Pennsylvania on an explicit willingness to subvert future election results. I should say, on an explicit willingness to use the power of the governor's office to subvert future election results. Now, here's a good example of how our discourse, I think, fails to capture the seriousness of the moment. It's often explained to readers as being something along the lines of, oh, he's a purveyor of Trump's big lie about 2020, or he's a Trump loyalist who tried to help overturn the 2020 election. And that's all true, but it makes it sound as if he's kind of a backward-looking figure. He's obsessed with some weird mythology that happened a few years ago. He's just doing it to sort of signal his loyalty to the Trump movement in some sense that doesn't have actual real-world implications. But here you've got a guy who's explicitly saying, put me in the governor's office so that I can subvert future election losses. Put me in the governor's office so that a Democrat doesn't win this state again in the presidential race as long as I'm there. And, you know, to answer your original question about the proportionality of attention here, Josh Shapiro is running on a vow to certify the rightful winner of the presidential election. Now, does that deserve, I guess that deserves attention, but I think the outlier here that is the thing we should be kind of talking about is Mastriano.
Yeah, in that sense, it's more the man bites dog story than the dog bites man story. The relationship between today's populist conservative Republicans and the media is obviously a big subject and was very deeply involved with Donald Trump's rise. So I want to go to your 2018 book, An Uncivil War. For those who aren't familiar with it, I highly recommend it. But What's also interesting about it is that in no way is sort of a repackaging of columns, which people in your position sometimes do to produce books.
I noticed that, yeah.
From what I understand, you had to take a leave of absence, and you clearly engaged in a really deep study of a whole corpus of political science to try to understand where we are at this current political moment.
Well, I was still writing once a day.
Wow.
Throughout the whole period. So
I'm shaking my head. People can't see that, but I just don't want to even understand that. But anyway, go on.
Oh, well, so yeah, I mean, the Post very generously allowed me to, you know, a little time in the afternoons to work on it. And so I did that. And I really appreciate you noticing the political science dimension. I tried to crunch through a lot of the work on this. And I don't know if I succeeded or not. I think there are plenty of mistakes I think I made. And I would probably do it differently today. In fairness, at that point, Trump hadn't been impeached twice and hadn't tried to overturn our constitutional order. So I was kind of operating from a position of a disadvantage there.
It's hard to think back to those golden days of 2018 before we knew what real trouble was, of course.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, maybe a lot of this was kind of foreordained by the stuff we were seeing from Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller and Trump himself. Trump was engaged in an extraordinarily corrupt effort to cover up the Mueller probe and bury its findings. And so, you know, maybe we could have reasoned from there that his corruption was going to only continue to expand, particularly if, as it seemed likely even then, he would have trouble getting reelected.
But the book does seem incredibly prescient in foreseeing that Trump was a threat, above all, to the continuation of constitutional liberal democracy in America.
Right. And you know, one thing that I think we all struggle with a little bit, and me included, all of us, is to get the balance right between saying that Trump represents kind of something extraordinary on the one hand, and on the other, a lot of these tendencies were present in the Republican Party for some time now. And that's, of course, your topic. You know that topic, I guess, as well as anyone alive.
Thank you. But if I were to actually quote your own sentence back at you, you wrote that the plight of our democracy is the result of a series of deep structural factors and problems that go well beyond Trump and long predate him.
Yeah, well, I tried to get the balance right. I mean, I do think I think that we're stuck in a strange argument, and this really ensnares a lot of liberals, I think. We're stuck in this place where if you start to talk about the threat Trump represents or represented, you're turning your eyes away from our structural problems, right? On the other hand, if you focus solely on our structural problems and the long-running anti-democratic tendencies on the right and in the Republican Party, you're, I think, taking your eyes off the ball of the degree to which Trump really did represent an exacerbation. And it's hard to get that right. I mean, what do you think, Jeff? You know the Republican Party's history better than anybody. I mean, isn't Trump both a continuation and an exacerbation?
Sure, in all kinds of odd and interesting ways. Matthew Continetti's new book on the right points out that Trumpism actually has considerable resemblances to the conservative republicanism of the 1920s, that in some sense he actually goes back to the kind of Harding-Coolidge model of a party nominally focused on the working class, all about protectionism, extremely hostile to immigration and cultural difference, but also at the same time, you know, kind of about normalcy, which Trump really is not. But the other thing is that, you know, it just seems to me the Republican Party is really struggling to come to terms with the fact that its base is now in the working class, and that at some level it is responsible for crafting policies that address the needs of that class. And on the other hand, it hasn't fully left behind either its sort of basic allegiance to the donor class or its resistance to governing. And those things would be true whether or not Trump had ever been president, whether or not he runs for office again in 2024.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on something important there. The allegiance to the donor class is still really quite strong, as evidenced by the fact that Trump, you know, it's not exactly clear what he campaigned on, because if you looked at his plans, they were sort of similar to standard Republican plans on taxes and healthcare, right? But there's no denying that on the campaign trail and in speeches, he sent strong signals that he was going to take on Wall Street plutocrats in a way that represented a fundamental break with Republican plutocracy. And indeed, he bolstering that picture, he deliberately triangulated himself against Paul Ryan-style hatred of the safety net. And so you could maybe argue that he was sending signals that he would support a kind of Herrenbulk welfare state or whatever it was. He strongly seemed to suggest a change in direction. And then once in the White House, he stocked the place with plutocrats and essentially dropped any real interest in raising taxes on the wealthy, and in fact delivered a multi-trillion dollar tax cut for corporations and the rich. And now we're in a strange situation where Republicans who are trying to carry on the sort of Trumpist essence that you referred to, i.e. the sense that they now represent the working class in a way that they didn't before, you have those Republicans campaigning against woke capital and so forth, and globalist capital and so forth. But at the same time, they still don't support actual policies that would cut down on legitimate globalist capitalists, such as a higher global minimum tax, which would make it harder for multinational corporations to evade taxes. And so there you have that tension. I do think that in people like Josh Hawley and Marco Rubio, there is, in some sense, they do represent something different in that they acknowledge that markets are creatures of government and that we can use government and politics to change market and even distributive outcomes, something that the Republican Party of Paul Ryan just basically doesn't treat as an existing truism at all, right? But it's really hard to sort of parse out where they end up with that stuff. It never gets that far. The cultural stuff always seems to subsume it in some sense.
Yeah. And I mean, again, to return to the discussion of the moment, Republicans are saying that gun control can do nothing to stop Uvalde or Buffalo type shootings, that it's all a mental health issue. And yet their credibility on actually doing anything to fund mental health is about zero at this point.
You know, this brings up something I'd love to bounce off you as a longtime observer of the right and someone who's been very shrewd on what the new right means. So when I think about something like gun control or government actions amid a global pandemic health emergency, I think those are things that could build a sense of solidarity among citizens. We're all agreeing that this problem is unacceptable, that it's harming people, innocent victims. We need to act together in some sense or other to mitigate that harm. This would reinvigorate a kind of sense of civic virtue. And you have new rightists like Josh Hawley and Blake Masters and J.D. Vance sending a strong signal that they really do think of populist right-wing politics as inculcating virtue. And yet when it actually comes to things that we could do in terms of collective action that would foster virtue, that would protect people, that would reinvigorate our sense of purpose, they just disappear. They're MIA. And they go straight back into the conventional kind of Republican dorm room level libertarian bromides that we've heard for a long time and they're supposed to be against. What do you think of that, Jeff?
I think we're talking about two sides of the same coin. I think it's impossible to preach virtue in the citizenry if you don't practice it in your own right as a member of Congress.
Right.
And clearly these people's whole stock in trade is division, and not just division, but savaging your opponents as un-American and evil people.
Yeah.
You know, certainly there are some people on this new right who have openly trafficked with the QAnon conspiracy, which in its own way is more depraved and destructive than even the John Birch kind of radicalism that I saw back in the 1960s. And I think, you know, this also speaks to an absence of gatekeepers at all levels of the Republican Party and to some extent in the broader discourse as well.
Yeah, I'd like to try to add to that if I could. There's something in this form of kind of virulent right-wing populism that really tends toward a posture of perpetual enemy hunting. And that perpetual enemy hunting seems to me to be fundamentally at odds with the very goal of creating a politics that brings out virtue in people.
I fully agree. And again, you know, we don't know what the future holds here necessarily, but it was very instructive to look at the report that came out on the Southern Baptist Convention and how the same voices that are so scourging of perceived lack of virtue in others were themselves actively engaged in evil and were using the tenets of Christianity to cover up their own vices, basically.
That is certainly a very glaring example of it. I think of someone like J.D. Vance as saying to himself, you know, saying something like this: we're going to fight the globalists who are trying to loosen the bonds between us, who are trying to dissolve the civic bonds between us, who are flooding our communities with consumer goods to essentially put us to sleep so we stop thinking politically. This is more or less what he's saying, right? More or less what that type of right-wing populist says. And yet, when there's actually a chance to do something that involves summoning a sense of civic responsibility and mutual support, they just vanish into thin air, and it just becomes this. It becomes yet another liberal elite plot, right?
Yeah.
The perpetual need to create liberal elite plots around every corner just literally doesn't allow for a kind of empirical or values based look at what something like tightening accessibility to lethal firearms might actually accomplish.
You know, I'm in considerable danger here of throwing your own observations back against you, because you have written a lot about the new right and this movement toward some form of post-liberalism on the right as well. Yeah. But, you know, I was sympathetic up to a point with the critique, because you've recognized that, you know, this is essentially a rebellion against the Republican Party as much as it is against the Democratic Party. And there are indeed problems of the left behind parts of America that neither political party seem particularly interested in addressing, and the failures of the neoliberal system, if you want to call it that, to provide a decent living for people, made them susceptible ultimately to the kind of Trumpian demagoguery that we're seeing now. My problem is that, you know, when I put out my piece 4 years ago in the Times on what a Republican New Deal might look like, it was predicated on the idea that the Republican Party would take seriously their responsibilities as the party of the working class, and therefore it would actually much more resemble the party of Franklin Delano Roosevelt than the party of Paul Ryan. But they haven't crossed that bridge somehow or other. At this point, they've only come around to thinking that government is good if you can use it as a club with which to attack your cultural enemies. They haven't come around to believing that government and being in a position of responsibility in government gives them any responsibility for the welfare of their own base.
So I think I would give them a little bit of credit in this area in the following way, at least some of them. I do think some of them are fundamentally serious about breaking with the quote-unquote, the pseudo-libertarian ethos of the pseudo-libertarian slash plutocratic ethos of Paul Ryan's Republican Party. They really do appear to agree that market rules are set by politics, that distributive outcomes don't exist in this kind of pure free market, this place where there's nothing but the quote-unquote free market. They seem to be willing to say that because of this, we can actually structure government in a way that produces more desirable social outcomes. But it never really quite gets to where, say, progressive economists take it. And here's something I'd love to run by you and see what you think of it. I wonder whether the fundamental difference between economic progressives and this type of right-wing populist on economics, granting them good faith, right, is that the former, the progressives, take the concept of moral equality a little bit more seriously. And the reason I bring this up is if you look at a proposal by like a Tom Cotton in the kind of right-wing populist space, it might be something like, tax the shit out of university endowments to fund vocational education, right? Now, progressive economists would be 100% for funding vocational education more, or whatever education people want to get in order to realize themselves, sort of from the liberal perspective, right? And so for Tom Cotton, though, the policy must have a punitive element. It must be, as you said, it must be wielding a cudgel against some liberal elite somewhere. And also, the end result is something closer to hierarchy than equality, right? If the primary thing they want to fund is vocational education, that doesn't seem particularly liberal, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never quite know to what extent the proposals that come out of the mouths, particularly of politicians on the right, are performative versus seriously intended. But my general acid test is, can you in any way picture these Republicans getting some of their Democratic counterparts to sign on to it? And when you include something so, you know, punitive as the idea that you're going to tax Harvard out of existence, it's obvious that that's not something Democrats are going to support. So right. It's pretty much just posturing for, you know, the base and the Fox News outlets of the world. But, you know, on the other hand, what you're pointing to is an area where a Republican Party reorienting toward a working class base and a Democratic Party that still in some level thinks of itself as the party of the people could find an awful lot of common ground, particularly on issues like vocational education. And yet the debate either gets drawn toward abolish the universities or, on the other hand, on the Democratic side, do away with school debt. And it seems that, you know, a possible chance for collaboration gets lost in the midst of culture war.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And what I really wonder, I agree with you that you can never really quite tell how performative some of the stuff is. But if you sort of take it, if you take it at face value, if you grant it the presumption of good faith, I still don't see in what sense they take the basic insight that government can be restructured to produce better social and distributive outcomes, to what degree they take that to a place of actually trying to achieve something close to liberal moral equality, and they just don't seem there.
I think, again, it's just gets lost in tribalism. Donald Trump, in his early days in office, proposed a $2 trillion infrastructure bill and even had the heads of a number of large construction unions in there to support this bill taking shape. Fast forward to today, and Trump is trying to get people to primary out of office any Republicans in the House who actually voted for the Democrats' $1 trillion infrastructure bill.
You highlight a point that I've actually wrote a piece about this very point, and I think people forget this, but I'm going to bring it up because it's an obsession of mine, and you know, and I hope that your listeners find it interesting. But just after Trump won, Steve Bannon, who is the keeper of the flame of populist Trumpism, gave a really, I think, an important interview where he said, we are going to spend $2 to $3 trillion on infrastructure. We're just going to throw money at shipyards. I don't know why he talked about shipyards. You know, maybe he's thinking about, I think, didn't he have, did he do a stint in the Navy, maybe?
He has a fondness for yachts.
Maybe it could be that, yeah. But anyway, so Bannon said, we're going to remake the Republican Party, and we're going to, you know, summon into existence a massive multiracial working class realignment. And, you know, when I read that, I was like, holy shit, what if they actually do that? Mm. Right. And of course, that quickly ran aground because Steve Bannon lost interest in the economic side of Trumpism and quickly became obsessed with his efforts to keep out desperate migrants. Mm-hmm. Remember, one of the first things he did, and it was a disaster, was the Muslim ban. And he and Stephen Miller really obviously prioritized keeping desperate migrants in as terrible a situation as possible and keeping them out at all costs above any kind of economic goal for Trumpism. And so what you say about Trump attacking Republican primary candidates for the explicit reason that they supported infrastructure just goes to show you how hollow that aspect of Trumpism always was.
To turn the focus back to the Democrats for a moment, in your book, you correctly anticipated the Democrats would be back in power by 2021. But to your credit, you didn't just stop there. You then sort of thought about to what extent Democrats should try to unilaterally disarm themselves versus in the face of what you call Republican constitutional hardball, which I guess is a term that you borrowed from Tushnet, the legal scholar at Harvard. So if I'm reading you correctly, remembering this, what you basically said was that the Democrats shouldn't actually fight fire with fire. They should not imitate what the Republicans have done in terms of breaking norms or engaging in their own kind of constitutional hardball, but they should also strive to make the system more rewarding for fair play. How do you feel about what the Democrats have done to this point versus what they should have done in the face of what likely is going to come along in the midterms this year and in the presidential election in 2024.
So can I first say that I think this is a really complicated question, hard to get it right. So I don't think I would say that Democrats shouldn't fight fire with fire ever. So take, for instance, gerrymandering, right? If the Republican Party is going to say, no, you cannot outlaw partisan gerrymandering, we're going to oppose and filibuster any effort to do that so that we can gerrymander to our heart's content in an effort to win the House, right? If Republicans are going to do that, I think there's a reasonable argument that Democrats in the states where they have the power to gerrymander should go ahead and do that, if only because what we're really talking about here is a national battle between two parties, right, over the makeup of the House. And in that case, in a case like that, I think Democrats are essentially playing by the rules that Republicans are insisting on, as opposed to unilaterally disarming themselves. So I think in some cases, fighting fire with fire is legitimate. But more broadly, it seems to me that the general goal should be to take the weaponry off the table for both parties wherever possible. And so you asked whether Democrats had succeeded in doing this or had tried hard enough. You know, I think they did try, right? The House, people forget this, but the House passed several major bills overhauling democracy, including an end to partisan gerrymandering. And the ultimate perverse irony, of course, the counter-majoritarian institution of the filibuster killed it in the Senate. And so clearly Democrats have been trying to take the partisan weaponry off the table for both sides, but have been frustrated by a couple senators from West Virginia and Arizona. So I think that it's hard to get this balance right. I don't think that Democrats should start suppressing the votes of working class whites the way Republicans try to suppress the votes of Democratic constituencies. To me, that would be a bridge too far in the direction of fighting fire with fire. And by the way, some leftists criticized that idea back when I said it. But I think you could argue that some things like maybe a much more aggressive approach to some of the judicial wars would be fair game. It would be fair game to gerrymander if Republicans are going to insist that the national battle over the House be infected by gerrymandering. It's hard to figure out how to both stand for the proposition that we should disarm and pursue fair play on the one hand, while on the other, not unilaterally disarming. It's very hard to figure out how to get that right.
It did seem to me that in your book, you were calling for Democratic prudence, at the least, when it came to abolishing the filibuster.
Yeah, I think I was wrong about that. And in my defense, this was before Trump had tried to use military money appropriated by Congress for Ukraine to strong-arm Ukraine into manufacturing a scandal to defeat his domestic opponent. Before he got impeached for that, before Trump spent months trying to overthrow an election and destroy our constitutional order with the support of many in the Republican Party, before he got impeached for that, and before Trump incited a violent mob attack on the Capitol in order to carry out his procedural coup, including directing the mob essentially to bay for the head of his vice president. So, you know, I think things are now, having watched the way Manchin has used the filibuster in such a bad faith way to frustrate basic advances that would preserve democracy and fairness, I think I was wrong about that.
What is to be done, in your opinion? What should the Democrats be focusing on in the lead up to the midterm election, in the lame duck, and then in what may be a Republican-controlled congressional era?
Well, I've said this in a couple pieces, but and I should probably credit Brian Beutler over at Crooked Media for this idea, which I think is an important one. But I think Democrats have to be clearer about what they would do if they were able to, say, gain two more or three more senators in the 2022 elections. Instead of just saying, give us more senators, right, and we'll codify Roe, they should say, give us more senators and we will have 50 votes to reform or suspend or potentially end the filibuster. And here's what we will pass with that newly created power. in my view, taking to develop Brian's argument a little bit, in my view, that would actually address that would have, I think, a civically important goal, which would be to address people's the widespread kind of dismay about the paralysis of the system in the face of things like the mass murder of children and the Buffalo shooting, the mass murder of children in Texas and the Buffalo shooting. I think Democrats should be telling voters, you do have recourse to get around the problems in the system and the obstacles in the system that are preventing us from acting. And I think that would be a way of telling voters that they, that all is not lost, that they do possess some power and recourse and agency here.
How do you feel now about some of what might be the more small bore or focused reforms that you recommend in the book, such as pushing for automatic voter registration, having neutral commissions draw district lines, maybe even trying to seek a compromise with the Republicans on voter ID in exchange for making ballot access easier?
I would be fine with a compromise like that. Just to start at the last thing you mentioned, I'd be fine. I think that there would be a way of structuring voter ID in a way that would mitigate any harms or suppressive effects it could have. And if we could get Republicans to agree to making voting easier, it would be a worthwhile thing to do. And I'll probably get some shit for this, but it seems to me that having bipartisan buy-in to Democratic reforms, if you can get it, is a positive. Might as well try to get that. That isn't to say we shouldn't do that. That isn't to say Democrats shouldn't do, purely partisan reforms to democracy and protections for democracy if they can and if they must, if Republicans won't participate. But I would think that getting bipartisan buy-in would be a positive in and of itself. On automatic voter registration, I think that would be a big, big step forward. And I will tell you, I still don't understand this, right? But the entire lesson of the Trump 2016 victory and the Trump 2020 run, in which he built on his 2016 totals and got unprecedented numbers for Republican, in which he inspired tremendous turnout in his parts of the country, I would think that Republicans would look at that and say, you know what? There is this constituency out there that we can activate in our favor. Let's make it easier for them to participate. I do not understand why they don't take that set of facts, that set of circumstances, and leap from there to more voter suppression. I do understand it. But if they were, I would like them to think about it as a way, I would like them to think about those factors as reasons to make participation easier, not harder.
How do you feel about some more ambitious reforms you proposed in the book, such as instituting limited terms for Supreme Court justices?
Well, clearly a lot more important right now, right?
Yeah. How would you see the possibility of the Senate passing Electoral Count Act reform?
I think there's a chance. I don't know how good a chance there is. And by the way, I think there may be some Democratic obstacles to this at some point, too, which we shouldn't turn our eyes away from. It's plausible that you could see some defections among liberals, both in the House and in the Senate, over an ECA reform that doesn't also include measures to combat voter suppression. I don't think that should derail it, but it may. As for Republicans, I think it's still a pretty tall order to get to 10 Republicans, although it seems like there's something close to that in some of these working groups. I don't really see why Republicans would oppose reforming the ECA, and here's why. It seems to me that if I'm a Republican who doesn't want to come under pressure from Donald Trump in 2024 or a Donald Trump imitator in 2024 to steal the election for him, I try to make it harder to steal the election so that I don't get pressured. I mean, we talk endlessly about the fact that a few very heroic and well-placed Republicans helped stave off disaster, and that's absolutely true. But so take, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp or Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger or some of the election level officials in some of the other swing states, they did perform heroically. But they were under tremendous pressure to do the opposite. We're talking about a mass movement that was mobilized by Trump, chanting about vote counters, that they were corrupt and threatening people. And do we really, if you're a Republican, do you want to be in that situation again?
I would think not, but I have almost come to despair of making rational arguments to Republicans about what's in their best interest. I did notice that you were alert to the fact that former Republican member of the House from Wisconsin, James Sensenbrenner, had pushed forward a bill to update the Voting Rights Act, and that Democrats didn't seize on this. Do you feel that was a missed opportunity, or that there never really was a chance that even a Republican-sponsored bill to do that would find any success in Mitch McConnell's side of the Senate?
I mean, as a general matter, I think I sympathize. That, you know, as a close reader of Twitter, you probably have noticed that whenever somebody suggests anything like a Democrat should try to reach a compromise with Republicans on something, you get met by a flood of LOLs and about maybe 1,000 little videos of Charlie Brown and Lucy.
Yes, yes. And any suggestion of bipartisanship, you better enjoy the ratio to come.
Right. Yes, exactly. But I think as a general matter, Democrats have to pursue these opportunities where they can. You know, take the current situation right now, right? Chris Murphy is trying to get a deal with some Republican senators on fairly modest gun reforms in the wake of the horror in Texas, right? And this, again, is getting hit with a flood of LOLs and Lucy and Charlie Brown and the football and so forth and so on. But if you really think about it, the horror of the situation really requires Democrats to try to pursue this to whatever degree they can, even if it seems hopeless. And so I just don't see why they shouldn't pursue these things when they can. It's not like it deprives them of the opportunity to do it by themselves at some future time if they get two or three additional senators. And to be clear, I'm not making the sort of silly political argument that, well, if they pursue Republicans, it will show that they're unreasonable, right? I don't think that that's why Democrats should pursue Republican support, because Republicans don't pay a price for that kind of thing. I think Democrats should pursue Republican support on the off chance that it's remotely a possibility, especially on something like guns, right? And that by the way, that points to a real perversity about this situation. I think it's more than likely that Mitch McConnell is saying that he's open to some sort of gun safety deal precisely because he wants to get headlines saying Republicans are open to some sort of gun safety deal at the moment when public angst is kind of at its height over the shooting, the most recent shooting. And then he kind of fully intends to essentially let the deal fall apart, or you know, he fully intends that 10 Republican senators won't materialize. And once public anger has died down, it's a little easier to say, well, Democrats asked for too much. We were willing to talk and they're just crazy, right? And so the perversity here is that precisely because the situation's so terrible, requiring Democrats to pursue whatever opportunity exists for action, that really, Mitch McConnell is putting them in a terrible spot, right? His bad faith is really compelling them to pursue Republican support because there's no other option. And I find that to be a sort of deeply perverse fact about the situation.
You know, if I were to find any grounds for hope in your book, though, it's that you interviewed people like Chris Janowski, who had put forward the Red Map project that really, coming out of the 2010 election, allowed Republicans to redistrict majorities in so many states. And yet even he feels now, as he spoke to you, that we need guardrails, that this system is just causing too much dysfunction to our country that we can't sustain ultimately. Do you think there is going to be some kind of move back in that direction of realism, if you want to put it that way, on the Republican side?
I mean, I think you'd be better positioned to answer that question than I would, because you really understand how this party works, I think, on a level that I don't really. But it's hard to be optimistic, isn't it? I mean, after all, we're in a situation where no matter what comes out about the January 6th insurrection attempt and the months-long plot to overturn our election, no matter what comes out about those things, Republicans are still trying to frustrate even the most basic accounting into what happened. They're still refusing to even admit that something uniquely terrible and threatening happened and that our political system needs to act in response. And so having seen that, it's hard to know what talks them back into a posture sort of along the lines of what you're suggesting. But I'd love to hear, if you have an optimistic note to add here, I'd love to hear it.
I tend not to be much of an optimist, but again, the recognition of someone like Janowski that, we are in a really bad situation. I have to believe on some level that most Republicans in office haven't gone fully over to the populist authoritarian party, that they retain enough of the old Republican Party, even of the Reaganite Republican Party, that they care about the country and aren't willing to put it through the things that Donald Trump would put it through. I realize that's not much grounds for hope, but I actually found your conclusion to be kind of inspiring, which is that the only option is for all inclined to keep slogging away at it wherever possible. And I think that's probably the lesson that I would like to take from your book as well.
Well, I appreciate that. I wish I felt as optimistic now as I did then. But can I say, Republicans don't even need a virtuous reason to support reforms like fixing the Electoral Count Act. They can do it out of pure self-interest. They can do it because they don't want to be the guy who Trump harangues viciously and violently for weeks because he won't help Trump steal the election, next election for him, or Trump wannabe, right? They can just sort of say, okay, well, we're just fixing this little hole. Trump will try to say that anyone who supports reforming the Electoral Count Act is his enemy. But now you see people like Mitch McConnell moving away from Trump in certain areas, and you hear a lot of talk about how Trump's grip when it comes to the anti-democracy tendencies that he's tried to unleash is weakening a little. You saw the Georgia Governor Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, survive their primary challenges. Yes, what happened in Pennsylvania with the Republican gubernatorial primary is terrible, but there are some glimmers that in order to survive Republican primary politics, you're not required to vow to overturn future election losses. And so you'd think they'd be able to get to something as technical as ECA reform, if only in their own interests, but I just don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, let's hope for the best. Greg, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
And thank you all for listening to the Vital Center podcast. Please subscribe and rate us on your preferred podcasting platform. And if you have any questions, comments, or other responses, please include them along with your rating or send us an email at contact@niskanencenter.org. Thanks as always to our technical director, Christy Eshelman, our sound engineer, Ray Ingenieri, and the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C.